Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. Another week has gone by, and the New York State budget is still late. As the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports, one of the items holding up a deal is a housing package that would build new affordable housing and strengthen tenant protections.
It's the second year in a row that Governor Kathy Hochul and the state legislature have tried to enact plans that would ease the state's affordable housing crisis. This year, a scaled-back proposal would offer grants to communities who agree to sign a pro-housing pledge. It would also revive a tax break for real estate developers who include affordable housing in their projects. The biggest sticking point, though, is over tenants' rights. Progressives in the legislature want to enact a proposal known as good cause eviction. It would prevent landlords from evicting tenants without a good reason, and it would cap rent increases at around 3%. Landlord groups are pushing back against the measure, though, saying it would further depress the long-term rental market. Senate Republican Minority Leader Robert Ort says the housing proposal does nothing for areas outside of New York City, and he predicts good cause eviction would be a disaster.
Which is essentially tenancy for life. And good cause is nothing more than a direct attack on private property rights in this state.
Even some Democrats in the legislature have been reluctant to vote on good cause. The measure died last year. Meanwhile, tenants' rights groups fear the measure will be watered down in any final housing agreement. Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins earlier in the week said there are a number of moving parts in the housing package. She says nothing has been decided yet.
We want to be able to build, and we want to be able to protect tenants. And so because there are so many elements to this housing package, short-term, long-term, there's so many stakeholders involved, you know, to get a complete package with everyone seeing progress in what it is we are trying to achieve and actually attaining and achieving that progress is where we really need to land.
Senator Stewart-Cousins says she believes a housing package will come together, but she can't say when. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt for the New York Public News Network.
Meanwhile, minority Republicans in the New York State Legislature are asserting their opposition to proposed tenant protections as lawmakers continue to negotiate over the overdue state budget. The Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard with that side of the issue.
State Senate Minority Leader Rob Ort gathered with members of both chambers this week to oppose what's referred to as good cause eviction.
Good cause is nothing more than a direct attack on private property rights in this state. And that is the case because some of my colleagues simply do not believe in private property rights.
The Republicans' press conference at the state capitol was organized as good cause eviction is being discussed as part of a larger housing package in the budget. The availability and affordability of a place to live in New York has been a top priority of lawmakers and Governor Kathy Hochul, who could not come to full agreement on a housing plan last year. Good cause requires landlords to provide grounds for a tenant's eviction and adds protections against steep rent hikes. Advocates say there is no greater time for the legislation than now, in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, when emergency eviction protections expired. But even before the pandemic, the legislation says, in 2019, 92,000 people in New York were homeless, and 100 families were evicted every day. Daniel Atona of advocacy group For the Many rallied alongside lawmakers during a recent press conference on regulating short-term rentals. He says good cause eviction is one key piece of a housing package puzzle.
At For the Many, we believe in good cause eviction, tenant protections, and green social housing. But we also believe that there is no single fix for our complex housing crisis.
The good cause eviction bill does not apply to landlords with less than 4 units. Still, upstate Republicans dismiss the legislation as a New York City issue. Again, Ort.
Good cause is a New York City creation. There is no one outside of that that would have ever come up, or this would never gain any real traction.
Our residents do sometimes need additional regulations to be able to help support them, especially for so that they're not taken advantage of.
Steve Noble is the Democratic mayor of Kingston. The Ulster County City has instituted its own short-term rental regulations and recently had its own rent control regulations under the state's Emergency Tenant Protections Act upheld in appellate court. Noble says he wants statewide tenant protections and incentives for communities to build all kinds of housing.
And so we've been a big supporter of good cause eviction. We think that it should be really clear on what are the reasons that people can be evicted and what are the reasons that they shouldn't be evicted.
The good cause eviction proposal says annual rent hikes of greater than 3% or 1.5 times the annual percentage change in the consumer price index are presumed to be unreasonable. But not all Democrats are completely on board with good cause. Assemblymember Pat Fahey of Albany says good cause eviction has become a pretty loaded term.
I think we have to address tenant protections and tenant needs, especially among the low income, one with more housing vouchers. Just to make it more affordable for those low income. We need some protections in terms of counsel, a right to counsel and housing court, things of that nature. We need to look at how to minimize rent increases because we have seen gouging in certain high rent areas. So there are some, but I think there are other parts of good cause. Tying something to the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, is just going to, if not done, it can have a chilling effect on growing housing.
Republican Assemblywoman Mary Beth Walsh of Ballston in Saratoga County says she likes the idea of compromise, but does not believe good cause is a good idea.
When you take something that started at a 3% and you say, well, we're compromising now, now it's going to be 10% or 5% plus CPI or whatever the proposal is right now, as near as we can figure it out as it's being reported, I don't support it because I think fundamentally it's just a bad idea.
In 2021, the city of Albany became the first in the state to implement its own good cause eviction law before it was struck down. An appellate court sided with landlords in a 2023 decision, saying it conflicted with state law.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustino. This week I sat down with Lauren DeRosier. She's the senior staff attorney, adjunct professor, and incoming director of the Immigration Law Clinic at Albany Law School. I asked Lauren to start by explaining the difference between migrants and immigrants.
So I think that one of the things that I have seen recently over the past couple years is a shift in terminology from a collective focus on immigration and immigrants to kind of separating communities. So now I think some of the verbiage and terminology that New York City, for instance, is using is kind of splitting people between asylum seekers and migrants. And I think that that's the wrong approach because I think that it artificially creates division between a community and it posits one group as more worthy than another group without actually being based in anything particular. And I think that migrants in particular, I want to steer away from because that is often a term that is outside of the immigration structure. There's like a view in that kind of word that means that people aren't actually able to access the legal immigration system. And that's not necessarily true because I think that the immigration system as it currently exists is in many ways very broken, but it's a lot more complicated. It's not cut and dry. And just because somebody might not have status right now or might not be eligible to pursue status right now doesn't mean that they won't be in the future.
And isn't there a huge misconception among the American people about whether someone's here legally or illegally? I'm speaking specifically of asylum seekers, for example.
Yes. Every time I teach immigration law, I do a little dance at the front of the room to walk through how varied and gray most of immigration is. It's not you have status or you don't have status. There are varying types of status. They're temporary. there are some where you might be able to stay in the United States despite having a removal order having been entered against you. And it's a much more complicated, nuanced, ongoing process rather than a state of being. So for instance, it's not illegal. There's no criminal penalty for just being in the United States without documentation. That's not a crime. And I think talking in terms of legal or illegal, that misconstrues the way that immigration actually works, and it puts it in criminal terminology context. Immigration law is not criminal law.
That's Lauren DeRosier, senior staff attorney, adjunct professor, and incoming director of the Immigration Law Clinic at Albany Law School. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustino. New York U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand is calling on her peers to reauthorize the Northern Border Regional Commission, a federal partnership with Northeast states to promote economic development. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley with more.
The commission was created in 2008 and has been reauthorized twice since, in 2014 and in 2018. Its authority is set to expire on September 30th, unless it is again reauthorized. It provides grants for economic and community development projects in border regions of New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine. Senator Gillibrand, a Democrat, says federal economic policies had not met the unique needs of the northern border regions until the commission was created.
The federal-state partnership provides funding for community development and economic projects and represents key economic development driver for communities across the several northern states. In New York, the commission is authorized to provide support for projects in 28 counties and helps to fund everything from infrastructure and Main Street revitalization to workforce development. Since 2016, the NBRC has invested in over 70 projects, totaling more than $36 million in investment in upstate New York. These are high-impact projects that meet the unique needs of upstate communities.
Speaking on a virtual press conference, Gillibrand adds the commission is limited by an outdated program authorization and limited funding.
To address this, I'm pushing to pass the bipartisan Northern Border Regional Commission Reauthorization Act. This legislation would reauthorize the commission and increase its capacity to meet the needs of distressed counties in upstate New York. It would give the commission new authorities to support rural housing projects, infrastructure resilience, and programs for the planning, construction, and operation of health, nutrition, and childcare projects. And it would help make sure that the commission better coordinates with other federal agencies for a whole-of-government approach to economic development. Key provisions from this legislation were included in the bipartisan economic development reauthorization package that was passed out of the Environment and Public Works Committee recently.
Northern Border Regional Commission Federal Co-Chair Chris Saunders says reauthorization is important for a number of reasons.
It sets benchmarks for potential funding levels for the commission. It makes a number of operational changes that allow the commission to operate in a more streamlined fashion. It offers some new policy area focus that Congress is interested in the commission working on. And a reauthorization would enshrine in statute funding limits or upper funding potential limits for the commission's work for the coming years. We are looking forward to a reauthorization. I think it's important to note that we don't sunset, so NBRC will not cease to exist without an authorization, but the authorization is really an important guiding document.
The Economic Development Reauthorization Act of 2024 passed out of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee on March 12th would reauthorize all regional commissions and makes technical changes to their functions. It also creates two new regional commissions for the Mid-Atlantic and Southern New England regions.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
The Dutchess County Legislature passed a resolution this week authorizing the county to sue New York State over a new law moving some local elections to even-numbered years. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King with that story.
The resolution passed 14-7 with three legislators absent. Governor Kathy Hochul signed a law in December moving some local elections, including those for county and town offices, to run alongside state and federal elections in even-numbered years. The Democrat says the move will save money, increase voter turnout for local races, and help combat voter fatigue. However, Republicans in the Dutchess County Legislature say the law violates home rule and conflicts with the county charter, which specifically says local elections must take place during odd-numbered years. Here's Legislator Faye Garrido.
The means by which we elect our county officials is the central pillar of our charter. This is not to suggest that changes cannot be made, but the charter prescribes a process for making such changes, which is by the voters. In haste, they've entirely disregarded the wishes and votes of the county residents.
Dutchess County is not alone in its thinking. Onondaga and Nassau counties have filed challenges with similar arguments, and the Oneida County Legislature has also authorized a potential lawsuit. And all 23 counties in New York have charters outlining their government structures and elections. The Dutchess County resolution sets aside $100,000 for County Attorney Caroline Blackburn to sue the state. While state law often supersedes county law, Blackburn says that isn't always true, and she's confident in her case. Democratic Minority Leader Yvette Valdez-Smith, meanwhile, says any lawsuit is a waste of taxpayer money.
My constituents that I do talk to all of the time just lost a bus route in Beacon. We continue to need EMS services throughout the county. We still have mental health program needs. We just allocated millions of dollars just now in our consent agenda on things that we really need. Again, my concern is taxpayer dollars.
Money was a big subject of Monday's meeting, including whether the new law will really save or cost the County Board of Elections. Democratic Commissioner Hannah Black did not return a request for comment, but GOP Commissioner Eric Haight estimates it will require the BOE to hire more staff during even-numbered years, even outside Election Day, to handle tasks like petition filing. If the ballot during those years becomes too long, it might even need new voting machines.
There is absolutely not a nickel in cost savings. If anything, at the very least, staff costs go up in the even years.
Democratic legislator Brendan Lawler argues voting equipment needs to be regularly updated and replaced anyway, and the new law doesn't take effect until 2025. Impacted positions elected that year will have shortened terms to bring them into an even year election cycle starting in 2026. John Caney is executive director of the watchdog group Reinvent Albany, which pushed for the new law. He says any argument that it will increase a burden on counties during even-numbered years is, quote, pretty lame, because the difference in turnout between on- and off-year elections is already night and day. While he expects there to be some costs and headaches up front, he says the move will actually save counties money down the line and increase voter participation on both sides of the aisle.
There's quite a few studies by political scientists, and it's pretty clear that people do vote more in even year. And the difference is really pronounced in presidential years when it's about three times as many people will vote in a presidential year than even in the highest odd year for local elections.
To be fair, the law does not fully consolidate local elections. That would require an amendment to the state constitution, something lawmakers are working on, but it'll take coordination to get it done by 2026. For now, voters can still expect to turn out in odd-numbered years for a number of races, including all local elections in New York City, all city and village positions, school board seats, judges and county sheriffs, clerks and district attorneys. Republican legislator Ryan Travelpiece worries those races could see even less turnout as a result, and that overall local issues will be overshadowed by the national political divide.
Wrapping our local elections into political media circus of the general election will not empower our voters to participate. Instead, the discordant nature of these races will undermine the integrity of our elections and trivialize local issues.
If Monday's vote is any sign, the resolution passed along party lines. Caney says he understands county's objections and the concern over home rule. He says it's reasonable for Dutchess County to sue. He just doesn't think it'll go very far.
The reality is that in New York State, the state meddles with absolutely everything at the local level. Why this would be so different than all the areas where the state already it has a pretty heavy hand in local activity, I don't see the courts deciding that in the county's favor.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustino. While all eyes were on the total solar eclipse that moved its way across the country, including upstate New York, where a Capital Region couple who lost touch for more than 30 years used Monday's eclipse to tie the knot, the Legislative Gazette's Samantha Simmons has more.
Charles Joseph Berry, you take this woman to be your wedded wife to live together in the estate of matrimony. Will you love, honor, and keep her in sickness and in health, and forsaking all others, keep yourself only unto her as long as you both shall live?
I do.
As the sky went dark, the light of love shined for the Berries at Scotia Village Hall. For 7 years, 62-year-old Lisa Ann Sokolowski and 63-year-old Charles Berry have lived together in Albany. Over time, the friends realized living their lives together was easy. Charles, who has suffered several heart attacks in recent years, says since moving in together, they've become each other's emergency contact. Lisa Ann says it felt like the right time.
We're not going anywhere. We're not going away from each other. We're not looking elsewhere. Let's also just make it easier as we hit this age and mortality and fragility starts to knock a little bit on the door. Being married makes me feel confident knowing that I can fearlessly go into any ER or hospital and say, I'm his wife. I want to see him now.
But how did they get here? A phone call in the late 2000s, but it all started well before that. Charles had transferred to Greenville Central High School in the Hudson Valley because his parents thought he would become a wild child if they didn't move. Charles says on his first day, he walked in and saw a beautiful girl with a great smile. Lisa Ann says he became her hero.
Back then, in the 70s, the big thing was your boyfriend, you know, escorted you from class to class. So I always had him with me. And then from where I lived in Earlton to Bern was probably a good, 25 miles round trip. And my parents indulged driving me out on New Year's Eve to go spend it with him at his parents' house.
They dated on and off in high school.
It would usually be about 9 months on, 2 months off, and then come back around again. And then it would be, excuse me, but you've been holding on to my Donna Summer Live album now for 8 weeks, and I would really like to hear it again.
But like most high school couples, they went their separate ways for college.
We didn't have cell phones back then, so once you moved away, you know, and you know, you're not in your parents' house anymore, it was hard to reconnect after we left Albany.
Charles went to work in show business, traveling internationally to model, design, and even helping the late Princess of Wales pick out her jewelry for the 1996 Met Gala, famously paired with her so-called revenge dress. At the same time, Lisa Ann was working in local journalism before moving to New England, where she eventually got a gig as an equestrian journalist. While living in New York City, Charles went to a play with old friends Dennis McDermott and John Emmett. McDermott now lives in Paris. He and Lisa Ann went to the College of St. Rose together. He says Charles would often visit Lisa Ann at school. At the play, McDermott asked if anyone had stayed in contact with her. Charles said he hadn't, but he never forgot about her. McDermott says in 1981, it seemed like they were married. In a message to WAMC, McDermott said, "I'm glad they finally did something about it. They complete each other." McDermott shared Lisa Ann's number with Charles, and the rest is history. Soon after, Lisa was on the train to see him.
Of all of the 365 days of the year that I could have chosen to have come down and to have seen him again for the first time in 3+ decades, turned out to be the anniversary of Jerry's passing.
In 2001, Charles's long-term partner died from HIV complications. Charles said it changed him and how he viewed relationships, turning him into a hard person.
I could see that kind of seeping out a little bit, and I didn't like that. You know, I didn't operate on that level. I didn't like sort of being curt with people, or I started not wanting to be around people.
That all changed when he saw Lisa Ann at the train station.
When I first saw her, I'm not making this up, yes, it was a gray day, but the lights from Grand Central, when she was coming towards me, it turned into a sunny day for just, you know, I don't know the time frame, but yes, you know, the streaming light through Grand Central at the time, and she was part of that light, and you know, everything was A-OK.
Lisa Ann, who was in a bad marriage at the time, felt the same way.
I remember it was a cold gray day in January, and looking out the window at the gray sky and going, what am I doing right now? And why do I feel like this? Is this going to change my life?
It did, but it took some time. The two remained friends for years, coming in and out of each other's lives. They say whether they realized it or not at the time, they both had careers where true friends were hard to come by and were lacking the love friendship brings. Over the holidays, they began toying with the idea of getting hitched.
It was very organic how it just, you know, it wasn't a, you're like, oh yeah, let's do this. But like, we just talked about it and like, yeah, okay, good. And then she said, I found the date. And I was like, okay. And here we are. So, it was all very easy flow for me.
The couple was married by village mayor David Buchafero, a family friend, before watching the eclipse from the sidewalk where they had just said their vows.
I am seeing the moon passing from right to left with a big, fat, fiery crescent of sun still on one side, and that glow is just bouncing off of the sidewalk. It's an eerie light. It really is.
Samantha Simmons, Scotia.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. You can listen to the Legislative Gazette anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2415 and join us again next week at this same time. For more news on New York State government and politics, for the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.